Hey, it's Ben Greenfield. Merry Christmas. If you're listening to this podcast during the week that comes out, it is Christmas week. As a matter of fact, today, the day that I'm recording this episode for you, it's my birthday. So celebration is in the air. I'm 21 years old. No, I'm just kidding. I'm a little older than that. But you can send me a bottle of your booze of choice if you really are convinced that it's my 21st. I'll take it. I'll take it all.
Well, if you're like me, you live a busy life. You don't really have time for many days off. That's why I talk so much about your mitochondria, because they generate about 90% of the energy your body uses. And keeping your mitochondria strong, it's one of the best ways to keep fatigue at bay. But these little mitochondria, darn things, are expensive to run. They use a huge amount of raw materials, especially when it comes to minerals. The problem is most people, including you and me, probably don't get enough minerals. And without minerals, your mitochondria don't have the cofactors they need to make energy. More than 97% of Americans don't get enough potassium. About 80% are deficient in magnesium. 40% are deficient in calcium. And those are three of the big ones. There's close to a dozen other trace minerals that are important for mitochondrial function, and most of us don't get enough of them, and you definitely can't get them from, say, table salt. It turns out that trying to take all the minerals you need by taking single mineral supplements isn't only hard because you need a ton of pills, but it's not the most effective way to get your minerals. That's why I take liquid, humic, and fulvic complexes. These are full spectrum mineral supplements, which means you get all the essential minerals your body needs in one go without a daily handful of massive amounts of pills or very large capsules or anything else that's hard to swallow. I use Beam mineral supplements because they're almost 100% bioavailable. They come in a liquid form that's easy to drink. It's just two bottles. I keep them in my pantry, throw back a shot a few times a day. They're a great way to refill your mineral stores, especially for those of you out here who are haunting your sauna on a frequent basis, or sweating, or doing hot yoga, or anything else. Keep your mitochondria running strong. So if you want to up your mineral game, give Beam Minerals a try. Go to Beam Minerals, B-E-A-M, minerals.com, and use code BEN at checkout for 20% off your first order. Well, if you're tired of spending hours on cardio with minimal results, then listen up, because I got a game-changing fitness breakthrough for you. The Carol Bike, science-backed, time-saving solution trusted by experts for optimizing health and longevity. They use this special form of a workout called a rehit, which allows you to achieve superior health and fitness benefits compared to regular cardio in 90% less time. That's amazing. That's a lot of time, 90%. Studies show that by doing Carol's 5-minute workout just three times a week, you can improve your fitness by 12%, reduce your risk of type 2 diabetes by 62%, and even wind back your internal body clock by 10 years. The science is clear. Carol Bike is your ticket to a healthier and more vibrant life. You got to try it to believe it and to see what I'm saying. I mean, it's not like a walk in the park. When you're pushing hard in those intervals, you're pushing, but then it's just like over and it's done and it walks you through it. It's very motivating. It's 5 feet away from me right now. It's right here in my office, my cool little exercise toy in my office. So you get $250 off your Carol Bike. You don't have to wait any longer. You can join over 25,000 riders and visit carolbike.com today. Carolbike.com. Hey, you want to spice things up in the bedroom and boost your sexual performance and do it naturally without nasty prescription drugs? You got to check out this stuff, Joy Mode. It's a powder. You can put it in water, or if you're like me and you're a savage, you can dry powder into your mouth. It contains clinically supported doses of L-citrulline, arginine, yohimbine, and vitamin C. So after taking this stuff called their Sexual Performance Booster, again, by Joy Mode, your blood levels of arginine and your yohimbine increase, and that directly promotes nitric oxide production, penile tissue relaxation, and increased drive. Well, the antioxidant action of vitamin C protects the nitric oxide from oxidative degradation, which then enhances the blood flow promoting activity of the nitric oxide. They thought of everything. They're super smart over at Joy Mode, and collectively these effects enhance sex drive and blood flow naturally to the penis or to the clitoris. My wife takes it too. It's amazing. You get better orgasms, better blood flow. You can kiss nasty prescription medications goodbye and have natural guilt-free energy for boosting your sexual performance. You can get 20% off your first order from Joy Mode. How? Go to usejoymode.com/greenfield. That's usejoymode.com/greenfield. J-O-Y. Usejoymode.com/greenfield. That'll give you 20% off your first order.
In this episode of the Ben Greenfield Fitness Show, research studies are very highly controlled and in very specific populations at specific doses for a specific duration. So making it into general advice for the general public is always a bad idea.
If you're a freelance writer, or even if you're on staff, like if you're on staff at the New York Times, you can come up with whatever headline you want because it has to be a certain length and it has to be catchy enough so people will click on the article.
He's an expert in human performance and nutrition. Voted America's top personal trainer and one of the globe's most influential people in health and fitness. His show provides you with everything you need to optimize physical and mental performance. He is Ben Greenfield.
Power, speed, mobility, balance. Whatever it is for you, that's the natural movement. Get out there. When you look at all the studies done, studies that have shown the greatest efficacy.
All the information you need in one place, right here, right now. On the Ben Greenfield Fitness Podcast.
Hey folks, it's Ben Greenfield, and it's probably no secret that I am a relatively voracious consumer of knowledge. I always have been. I used to sit in my bedroom when I was a kid and just read for hours and hours, and actually would often get punished by my parents, whether that's good or bad, I won't comment on that, not even coming out of my room when we would have very important guests over and old family friends because I had a fantasy novel to finish or I had some encyclopedia I was shoving my nose into. And still, on an average week, I read 3 to 5 books. I have a copious number of books on my bookshelf and several Kindles that are completely full. I listen to 15 to 20 podcasts a week. I read several dozen research articles per week. And one of my secrets to this kind of hyper-productive digestion of information is that I use services and websites and journals and newsletters and basically digests that disseminate information into readily accessible bite-sized pieces that let me cut through the clutter and get to the summaries and the takeaways and the actionable items from the content that I'm consuming. For example, I'm a huge fan of book reviews produced by guys like Derek Sivers and James Clear. And in addition, I stay up to date with health and medical and science news via these newsletters called the Stone Hearth newsletters. And I follow exercise and nutrition research on this website called Supversity. And for general life knowledge, I'm a recent subscriber to this blog called the Farnham Street blog for staying up to date with the best pretty recently published books and articles from around the web. And of all these things, there's one really comprehensive exercise, diet, and supplement resource that I access on a weekly basis. And I spend a ton of time on this website, spend a ton of time with the PDFs that they produce, and even the monthly digest that they put out. And that is the website Examine, over at examine.com. And it is produced and founded and directed by my podcast guest today, Kamal Patel. And Kamal is the director of Examine, like I just mentioned, he's also a nutrition researcher. He has an MPH and an MBA from Johns Hopkins University. He is, currently on hiatus from a PhD in nutrition, in which he's researching the link between diet and chronic pain. He's got a bunch of peer-reviewed articles he's published on vitamin D and calcium and a ton of other clinical research topics. So we're going to be taking a deep dive today into things like why the media and supplement companies lie to you about diets and supplements, how to find really good unbiased information, how to know whether or not the science that you're reading has been manipulated. And also we're going to delve into really good supplements, really good stacks. What are the most proven things that you can shove into your gaping maw if you want to get a better body or brain? So this will be a fun one, and I will keep notes on everything that we talk about in the show notes for today's episode, which you can find at bengreenfieldfitness.com BenGreenfieldFitness.com/examine podcast. That's BenGreenfieldFitness.com/examine podcast. So, Kamal, welcome to the show, dude.
It's my pleasure.
I'm curious how this all came to life, because when I go visit examine.com, I mean, there's like reams and reams of information on there. And I'm just wondering if it was just like you sitting there one day wanting to write up a nice article on creatine, or how this whole thing actually happened.
Well, it was actually sort of born out of Reddit and Reddit fitness and Reddit nutrition, the sub forums, right around 5 years ago. There's always been websites with a lot of information on nutrition and fitness and other health related topics, but there was never really a website that only provided information. So like when I was first getting into lifting weights, I used to read Usenet groups, and then luckily the web started, and then there was like bodybuilding.com, or I don't know what it's called now, but T-Mag, T-Nation, mm-hmm. I guess. I don't know.
Yeah, there's T-Nation, T-Nation.com. Plenty of pictures of vascular men and women on those.
Yeah,
sites.
And I remember they used to have motivational pictures that just got more crazy vascular every week. And that, you know, that motivated my 19-year-old self. So after a while, I figured out that the studies that were cited on those pages were really helpful. You know, you could go back, read the study. If you could understand stats and stuff, you could figure some things out. But anytime that you have a website where you sell stuff, you have to make money. And it's not bad nor good. You just have to make money to run a website. So any website that provided information like bodybuilding.com, it had a ton of good content, but it couldn't be systematic because they didn't have the manpower or woman power necessary to do all the research. And then if you sell stuff, then you're always going to have particular interests in things and possibly an angle for selling things. So again, that's not bad or good. It's just whatever the people are interested in. So Examine started to be sort of a systematic resource. And my background was in evidence-based medical practice. So we basically just do kind of what research centers do, but for supplements and nutrients, and we're not affiliated with the government. But other than that, we do a very similar thing that they would do.
So when you say we, I mean, how does it work? Do you guys have like an office where people are getting supplements and trying them and writing about them? Or do you just have like a team of folks who go to PubMed every day? Like, how does it actually work for you guys to put out all the information that's on examine.com?
So we're a virtual team, like I guess many teams nowadays. I live in San Francisco. We have people in Toronto and Ottawa and France and some other places. And basically, we've put out hiring calls in the past that have been moderately successful. But nowadays, I just look on the internet for people who are really, really curious about things and who are really analytical and you know, don't have a set position. And I'll talk to them and I'll see if they're interested, if they have open time. And we contract with people and occasionally hire them full time to, like you said, read through research. So we try to get people from different angles, like people interested in the pharmacokinetics of supplements, or people who have a public health background and know more about epidemiology, or people who have been in clinical practice, or people who haven't been in clinical practice but are just voracious readers. And then we look at research from a bunch of different angles, and then we summarize that stuff on our website.
Okay, got it. Now you say that you're like an unbiased source on nutrition and supplements. And when I scroll through the typical, like if I were to go to your website and I were to open up the page for, let's say, like beta alanine, it tells you, for example, you know, what it interacts with when you'd want to take it, basically a complete summary with literally dozens and dozens of research studies behind beta alanine. But when it comes to this website, I guess like floating itself with that huge team of researchers, you know, there's no links on there for me, you know, that I can see at least to actually buy beta alanine, or, you know, to go to some affiliate website like Amazon or something like that and purchase beta alanine. How are you guys actually kind of floating this site, or is it just like a labor of love?
So we do have products. All the information on the website is free. So 99% of what we do is publicly available and will always be, and will always be updated. And then in order to make enough money to, I guess, you know, pay the bills and to pay me, we do sell three products: a supplement reference guide, which which has information collected by different outcomes. Like, you know, if you have allergies, then you can click on a type of allergic reaction and see what studies have looked at that reaction. And then we also have a stack guide, a collection of stack guides for different goals like aesthetic, skin and hair, or muscle building, or that kind of thing. Just kind of very concise information on what and what doesn't have evidence. And then we have a research digest that comes out each month with some of the latest research papers that are important in different areas, and we tear them apart. So we look at them from every angle possible and try to be extremely critical of them. So with those things combined, we can keep the lights on and have enough staff at least to get through basically all the micronutrients and most important supplements.
Gotcha. And I actually want to delve into those in a little more detail later on, because I have and use all of those. Like the supplement reference guide is like, it's like 1,000+ pages long, but it lives on my desktop. And whenever people ask me about like some fringe supplement, I'll go see if it's actually proven and efficacious, or whether it's just something that's going to give them explosive diarrhea. So you've got this idea behind being an unbiased source on nutrition supplements, but you know, we're constantly bombarded, as you know, Kamal, by, you know, claims that fish oil is good for you, fish oil is bad for you. Or, you know, I know you guys do articles on everything from steak to eggs to probiotics. Now, how do we know if a supplement company or if the media is manipulating science for their own benefits? I mean, what are some ways that things like that are actually occurring out there?
Well, the general way that I like to think about that kind of thing is, you know, anybody who's really into reading stuff, like anybody who listens to this podcast, likes the idea of science and the scientific method. And supplement companies, you know, they're not really always trying to pull the wool over our eyes, but they are trying to make money. And then the media also, you know, they don't have perfect information. They're not in the life sciences. They don't have PhDs. So when they write about stuff, there's imperfect information there. So the way I like to think about this stuff is, the scientific method is about finding the truth through iteration and through finding out what's false in data. There are some markers of what's false, you know, like when websites have really crazy fonts and unbelievable transformation stories and stuff, then that's obviously false. But then there's been times when there's...
What do you mean fonts?
Oh, so... like for better or for worse, websites that look like they were designed in the 1990s usually either have outdated information, you know, the person isn't like with it enough to, you know, to keep up with what's going on in the internet. So there's a lot of kooky websites out there that people forward to us. And then I, you know, I try to read every message. So I comment back to them in a nice way. This is what to look out for, and this is what to not look out for. But we get a lot of emails from people who are in their 70s and 80s and stuff. And eventually I just started saying, you know, look at the website. Does it look believable? You know,
like,
that's
like, what, do you have any examples of websites that you've been to recently that are just like, I mean, I'm not asking to shove anybody under the bus.
Oh yeah.
I don't care if you give examples either.
Yeah. So, I'll try to come up with an anonymous one. So there was one where, you know, I'm sure you've done a variety of diets yourself, diet experiments, ketogenic diets, higher carb diets, whatever, cutting out foods. So you know that elimination diets are something that people commonly use to try to address their medical conditions.
Right.
So there was a website probably 3 or 4 years ago about somebody who's doing a nightshade elimination diet. So okay.
Like eggplants and potatoes, yeah, and things like that.
So tomatoes, potatoes, eggplants, red peppers, and then a couple other things. So I was interested in that stuff because just a year or two prior, I was doing my PhD research on elimination diets for rheumatoid arthritis. And there was this guy, there's actually not a lot of research on nightshades. There's some mechanistic research, and kind of the whole thing got started in like 1982 or so. There was an article about, I think it was cows or something in South America who became lame by eating some nightshade plants. And then they figured out it was arthritis that was induced by a vitamin D type compound in those nightshades. So,
right. Well, isn't it like the glycoalkaloids,
yeah,
in nightshades, like the solanines and eggplants and the
nicotine
and tobacco?
Yeah, all the nightshades have their own glycoalkaloids, you know, tomatoine or, you know, whatever And they can have different effects and different effects on different animals. So when that came out, then the sort of anti-nightshade, well, very minor anti-nightshade movement started, I guess. And then it started more in earnest when this guy who was a horticulturalist, who was actually a really smart guy, started doing some survey research saying like, oh, have you tried cutting out nightshades? What happened? Did your arthritis get better? And then his arthritis got better when he cut out nightshades. So I didn't see much actual research on it. And then I found this website, and it had good stories, but this makes it sound like I'm ageist, but it was by a person who was probably like 7 years old. And then they mentioned all these studies that were done, and they're like, oh, these studies show that if you cut out nightshades and your arthritis will get better, your fibromyalgia will get better. And I was skeptical because fibromyalgia is not a discrete condition often. You know, it's hard to diagnose. It can be a conglomeration of different things. It's definitely not like the nightshade condition. So I was like, he's really grouping a lot of things in here. And then I started going through the website, and it was on, I think it was transferred over from GeoCities. Do you remember that?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, vaguely.
So GeoCities was, I don't know, Yahoo's thing or something in the 90s, where you could have your own website, and it was one of the first things. So it was transferred from there, and the studies, when I actually tried to find the data, they weren't studies. They were surveys put out by this company that helped you reduce your nightshade intake. So the thing is, I'm not pro or against nightshades. You know, there is a mechanism for nightshade reduction and elimination diet for, you know, 2, 4, 6, or 8 weeks to see noticeable results. But this guy's website mentioned the vague term studies. And if you don't actually look into what the studies are, you can easily be tricked. So just over time, I got to think that whenever people put up websites and they didn't care enough to make the information readable, you know, if you're a good writer, or to make the website look somewhat good, you know, it doesn't have to be a professional website, but just a decent website, then be skeptical. So these are just heuristics that I recommend basically to older people who don't have the knowledge necessary to like tease apart if a p-value is important or not.
I have a couple of thoughts on that. The first is that like you don't necessarily think that like there's zero evidence that glycoalkaloids can be implicated with like joint or, you know, joint issues or arthritis related diseases, do you?
Oh no, I worked with a rheumatologist in Boston on the PhD research. Nightshades were probably like the number 4 or 5 association with rheumatoid arthritis. So,
okay.
So yeah, it's a thing. It's just like, I don't have a pro or against stance on almost anything, because I just think for some people, they cut out a lot of things, including nightshades, and then they see benefit and they peg it on nightshades.
Yeah.
So, yeah. That's always
me. I gotcha. Okay, that makes sense. And then, like, my other thought on that is, like, I guess just because a website is ugly or has, you know, an unattractive font, you know, to me, that doesn't necessarily turn me off right away. Like what I look for is, you know, for example, what's a recent one I was at? Super Memo. So there's a website called Super Memo, and they've got a section there on sleep, right? And it's honestly kind of ugly. It's not laid out that well, and it does look like it was made, you know, maybe like kind of late 90s-ish or early 2000s. But the number of well-cited research studies and the amount of obvious attention paid to citing claims that are made gives me a great deal of confidence in a website like that. So do you think that, you know, a website can be unattractive and ugly and even made to look like it was created in the 90s and still be a dependable source of information?
Yeah, you know, now that you mentioned that, I'm just going to retract my answer as a pretty bad answer. It's just because I mentioned to one person, look at the website, and, you know, if the person takes care to write well and if the website looks good, then maybe there's a higher chance that it's credible. But there's a lot of websites like the one you mentioned, like Vitamin D Wiki. It does not look good, but it has, you know, 5,000 citations for vitamin D articles that are very useful. So there are a lot of websites that don't make any attempt to look good, but are very useful. So more so than what the website looks like, if the website provides citations and then provides both the pro and the con side, then those are usually pretty good indications that the website is good. So if a website is all about something, then, you know, be a little bit more skeptical. But if a website says, you know, pros and cons of vitamin D supplementation at higher doses, then that might be an indication that it's useful.
Well, if you're tired of spending hours on cardio with minimal results, then listen up, because I got a game-changing fitness breakthrough for you. The Carol Bike, science-backed, time-saving solution trusted by experts for optimizing health and longevity. They use this special form of a workout called a Rehit, which allows you to achieve superior health and fitness benefits compared to regular cardio in 90% less time. That's amazing. That's a lot of time, 90%. Studies show that by doing Carol's 5-minute workout just 3 times a week, you can improve your fitness by 12%, reduce your risk of type 2 diabetes by 62%, and even wind back your internal body clock by 10 years. The science is clear. Carol Bike is your ticket to a healthier and more vibrant life. You got to try it to believe it and to see what I'm saying. I mean, it's not like a walk in the park. When you're pushing hard in those intervals, you're pushing, but then it's just like over and it's done and it walks you through it. It's very motivating. It's 5 feet away from me right now. It's right here in my office, my cool little exercise toy in my office. So you get $250 off your Carol Bike. You don't have to wait any longer. You can join over 25,000 riders and visit carolbike.com today. Carolbike.com. Well, if you're like me, you live a busy life, you don't really have time for many days off. That's why I talk so much about your mitochondria, because they generate about 90% of the energy your body uses, and keeping your mitochondria strong is one of the best ways to keep fatigue at bay. But these little mitochondria, darn things, are expensive to run. They use a huge amount of raw materials, especially when it comes to minerals. The problem is most people, including you and me, probably don't get enough minerals. And without minerals, your mitochondria don't have the cofactors they need to make energy. More than 97% of Americans don't get enough potassium. About 80% are deficient in magnesium. 40% are deficient in calcium. And those are three of the big ones. There's close to a dozen other trace minerals that are important for mitochondrial function, and most of us don't get enough of them, and you definitely can't get them from, say, table salt. It turns out that trying to take all the minerals you need by taking single mineral supplements isn't only hard because you need a ton of pills, but it's not the most effective way to get your minerals. That's why I take liquid, humic, and fulvic complexes. These are full spectrum mineral supplements, which means you get all the essential minerals your body needs in one go without a daily handful of massive amounts of pills or very large capsules or anything else that's hard to swallow. I use Beam mineral supplements because they're almost 100% bioavailable. They come in a liquid form that's easy to drink. It's just 2 bottles. I keep them in my pantry, throw back a shot a few times a day. They're a great way to refill your mineral stores, especially for those of you out here who are haunting your sauna on a frequent basis, or sweating, or doing hot yoga, or anything else. Keep your mitochondria running strong. So if you want to up your mineral game, give Beam Minerals a try. Go to Beam Minerals, B-E-A-M, minerals.com, and use code BEN at checkout for 20% off your first order. Hey, you want to spice things up in the bedroom and boost your sexual performance and do it naturally without nasty prescription drugs? You got to check out this stuff, Joy Mode. It's a powder. Put it in water, or if you're like me and you're a savage, you can dry powder into your mouth. Contains clinically supported doses of L-citrulline, arginine, yohimbine, and vitamin C. So after taking this stuff called their Sexual Performance Booster, again by Joy Mode, your blood levels of arginine and yohimbine increase, and that directly promotes nitric oxide production, penile tissue relaxation, and increased drive. Well, the antioxidant action of vitamin C protects the nitric oxide from oxidative degradation, which then enhances the blood flow promoting activity of the nitric oxide. They thought of everything. They're super smart over at Joy Mode, and collectively these effects enhance sex drive and blood flow naturally to the penis or to the clitoris. My wife takes it too. It's amazing. You get better orgasms, better blood flow. You can kiss nasty prescription medications goodbye and have natural guilt-free energy for boosting your sexual performance. You can get 20% off your first order from Joy Mode. How? Go to usejoymode.com/greenfield. That's usejoymode.com/greenfield. J-O-Y. usejoymode.com/greenfield. That'll give you 20% off your first order.
Now, in your guys' Examine Research Digest, which is like your monthly publication that you put out, that actually, is it twice a month now that that comes out?
Yep. Yeah. Once a month.
Okay. So it's because I remember it used to be like really big and once a month, and it always took me a long time to get through. Now that it's twice a month, I can get through it a little bit more quickly, which I like. But the research that you go through, sometimes you tell people like what you need to know, what to look for. And in some cases, you've pointed out studies that seem to appear credible, but that are flawed, for example. So when someone is online and on their Facebook news feed, or, you know, even, you know, if they've opened up USA Today or something like that, and, you know, there's a story about a supplement or a story about a diet or a story about an exercise program, are there red flags or certain things that people should look for that would allow them to question the legitimacy of the claims being made in, for example, a media headline?
Yeah. So there was a study done a couple of years ago, and I think the British Medical Journal, that looked at how research from the top 10 or 20 highest impact factor journals like New England Journal of Medicine and JAMA and whatnot, how those were translated in media headlines. And the three things that were present in the media headlines that weren't in the original research most often were positioning research as advice. So research studies are very highly controlled and in very specific populations at specific doses, you know, for a specific duration. So making it into general advice for the general public is always a bad idea. There were also a lot of times when studies were not implying causation, either because they were just observational studies or because causation couldn't be implied for statistical reasons or whatnot. But then the media headline said, you know, vitamin E causes cancer or whatever. And then there's also times when research was done in animals where the animal parts were very briefly mentioned. And animal research is not bad. Animal research can be very useful, but because occasionally animal physiology can be different, and then also animals get chow, you know, in a lab. They don't have a natural lifestyle like humans do, or rather an unnatural lifestyle.
Right. So when it says like a high fat diet is producing unfavorable, you know, health parameters in say like mice, a lot of times that high fat diet is essentially like lard and soy feed, for example.
Yeah. So like, now that you mentioned that, there's this whole thing about, is it bad to eat fat in order to, cause if you feed mice a lot of fat or any rodent, then their intestines will become more permeable. And it's the easiest way to make the intestine permeable through diet. So then there's the question of translation. For people who have gut issues, is it important to watch their fat intake in order to reduce parts of bacterial cells crossing through the intestine? And people don't really, really know the answer yet. And part of the reason is that we don't know a lot about different people's gut linings. But part of the reason is that when you feed mice a diet of high fat, you're feeding them a highly purified diet altogether, because they either feed mice a natural type diet or they feed them this chow that is soybean, et cetera, oil plus sugar plus, you know, whatever stuff. So they have a very dichotomous diet, whereas humans could eat, you know, like a bunch of purified fat. They could have a salad with olive oil salad dressing. They could eat rotisserie chicken. They could eat grass-fed beef. And then they also eat it in meals, often with fiber. And our guts are also different because we have different bacteria that live in our guts. So anytime you try to simplify animal findings for that, which is going to come out a lot in the next few years, there's going to be media headlines about, more and more media headlines about gut stuff. It's very hard to do. And especially in media reports, they never talk about previous research. So any one paper is just part of an iterative process. And if you don't mention the previous research that's done, then you're not really getting the full picture.
Yeah, exactly. Like, for example, I just wrote an article about this on marijuana, about the recent studies that showed that marijuana can increase the risk of a heart attack. And then if you delve in and you look at the study, you know, essentially what they did was they had mice stick their nose in this tiny little chamber filled with marijuana smoke and just breathe in the smoke for a full minute. And the researchers noted in the study, like they admitted in the study, well, a huge part of the endothelial dysfunction that they say that this marijuana is causing could be caused by the smoke itself, not anything in like the THC or the CBD from the marijuana. And furthermore, the other thing is that when they looked at this huge cohort of patients, this was the other part of the study, they looked at this huge cohort of patients who came into the hospital, you know, with you know, heart attack type of symptoms. There was the marijuana group that had a, one form of symptoms, like the endothelial dysfunction, and then the non-marijuana users had a different kind of heart attack risk.
Yeah.
And so, you know, the media could just have easily had said, oh, marijuana reduces risk of heart attacks, you know, but in this case, you know, they report marijuana increases risk of endothelial dysfunction or vascular dysfunction. And so, yeah, it's really interesting how you can take the results of scientific research and really spin it one way or the other, depending on what kind of message that you want to portray as the media.
Yeah, I don't think people understand that the media is not allowed to say we don't know. And if you can't say we don't know and you have to take a stance.
What do you mean they're not allowed to say we don't know?
So like you've written before for websites, right? Like outside of your own.
Mm-hmm.
If you're writing an article for major media, then you're not always in charge of the headline. You know, they'll come up with a headline, and if you're a freelance writer, or even if you're on staff, like if you're on staff at the New York Times, you can't come up with whatever headline you want because it has to be a certain length and it has to be, you know, catchy enough so people click on the article. So like really what a headline would be for that marijuana study or for a vitamin D study or whatever should be at minimum 10 to 15 words long, which it never is. And it should have some words like might or could or in some people. So like there was a, you know, the guy who wrote the paper about 90% of medical findings are wrong, whatever, no. 4 or 5 years ago. So there was this study came out by John Ioannidis, who is a methodologist, a professor in stats and medicine, that said 90% of medical findings are wrong. So it was really controversial. And then a lot of people kind of threw it around like, oh, I don't believe studies because there's a 90% chance they're wrong. So it's an extremely complicated issue, but it's probably the most important issue in all of nutrition research. Like, I'm sure you get this because, you know, as I understand it, you're a self-experimenter. And I've always been into self-experimentation, but also into research. And people mm-hmm. think that they conflict, you know, like, something works and then the research shows that it doesn't, so it must not work, or vice versa even. And it's a lot more intricate than that. So like that study by John Ioannidis was true because of very statistical reasons and the fact that journals don't really run like you would want them to run. They publish results that are bound to get them attention, for example, and a lot of negative research findings don't get published. Because of a variety of reasons, a lot of medical research is wrong. If you reproduced a trial, there's a good chance that it won't find significant findings anymore. So, like, for example, you know, the P is less than 0.05 is defined as significant. So the minimum that somebody would know about stats is, you know, you go to PubMed, you see that citrulline or vitamin D or, you know, vitamin B12 improves blood pressure. P is less than 0.05. So then you share it on your Facebook. Hey, vitamin B12 helps blood pressure, and this study shows it. It's not quite true because if anybody is really into stats who listens to the podcast, there's a bit of an internal war in biostatistics about frequentist statistics versus Bayesian, and I won't get into it at all because it's kind of boring, but also fun if you like stats. But the end result is that if you take a study that is, let's say, P equals 0.047, so that means it's less than 0.05 and it's deemed statistically significant, and you can go to your friends and say, hey, this study showed that vitamin B12 does help this. If you take that study and you reproduce it exactly, there's something like a 50 or 70% chance or something that it won't be significant anymore.
Mm-hmm.
So most people would be surprised because if you reproduce a study, you would think you would probably get close to the same result, but you don't. And the reason is that trials are very rarely large enough to be done again and show the same results. You know, a study will be done on 50 people and show a significant finding of P is less than 0.05, 0.047. But if you reproduce the study, then somewhere on the continuum of possible results, you'll get one of those results. And, you know, like, let's say you have a sugar pill that you test against another sugar pill, and you do that 100 times. Well, one out of 100 times, at least one, you know, 50 out of those 100 times, or not 50, five out of those 100 times, the sugar pill will be better than the other sugar pill and it'll be P is less than 0.05. And all of those results will get published because journals publish positive results. And the other, you know, however, 10, 20, 30, 40 times it was tested, won't be published. But if you reproduce that same exact experiment, it won't be significant. And then that result is not likely to be published again. Just a very small slice of the total pie of possible research. And that's what people don't really understand.
Yeah, it's really interesting. And you know, not to belabor the point too much about the, like, the carbohydrates versus the fat issue, for example, but, you know, to be fair to, like, the high carbohydrate diets, you know, in many cases, when they say that, like, a high carb diet causes issues, they're feeding rodents or mice, like, a bunch of acellular carbohydrates, right? Like refined sugars and grains. Whereas, you know, somebody eating, you know, whatever, you know, sweet potatoes and yams and underground roots and tubers and carrots and maybe quinoa or amaranth or millet or, you know, fermented and soaked and sprouted beans, they might have a completely different reaction than what they're reporting in a study, you know, on macronutrients. So, yeah, it's one of those things where, you know, that's why I appreciate what you guys do, is you kind of cut through that clutter and report accordingly. So, you know, the other one, and I also want to turn to some of the things that you found to be most efficacious, but the other one that I think is interesting, I'd love to hear your take on this, is this idea, for example, that athletes need a certain number of carbohydrates to perform well during exercise, like a certain mix of fructose and maltodextrin, for example. And when you look at studies in which they will say that, you know, a high fat diet, for example, does not benefit athletes, or athletes need a certain amount of carbohydrates to exercise, they always take a sample group, you know, for example, for a high fat diet, in which they feed them a high fat diet. They take them in off the streets, off a standard American diet, you know, feed them a high fat diet for 2 weeks, and then compare that to a group that's eating, you know, a normal, you know, recommended carbohydrate based endurance athlete diet. And they show that the carbohydrate diet is superior, but what they fail to do is actually have the athletes who follow, like, a high fat diet follow that for a year or 2 years or enough time to actually get the adaptive response to be able to, say, burn a higher number of fats for energy or oxidize more fats during exercise. And so in many cases, these research studies, they're short, right? Like they're 6 or they're 12 or they're 18 weeks long, or whatever diet they're feeding the participants is just a few weeks long, rather than looking at something that's more lifetime based or more, you know, 1 or 2 year based, just because research has limited time in terms of the scope of research in many cases.
Yeah. So the ideal experimental setup for that kind of thing would be to have a long lead-in period. So like you said, months, if not a year, where you're adapted to the diet. And then also have it be a crossover trial where you're both under the high-fat diet, high-fat, low-carb, and the high-carb diet. And then have a long washout period in between the times that you're doing those two experiments. So very few, if any, of the performance trials are like that. And since they're not like that, the scenario that ends up coming up is you do a small study because you have limited funding of like 10 to 20 people. And then you report that, you know, a certain group did better than the other group. And it's usually the higher carb group did better. But you could have it the other way, depending on how you design the study. And it's very hard to have those experiments be reliable, because in a very small proportion of the papers is the power calculation done, meaning the calculation that you would do before the study to show how many participants you need in order to find a result. And then if you don't do
what's that called? The power calculation?
Yeah. So if you don't do a power calculation, there's one of maybe like, there's like 10 to 20 basic things trials should do, or at least in the paper. And very rarely are all those things done. And when you don't do those things, like, when I was at my old position, the first project we did was the vitamin D guidelines. So in 2008 or 9, we were contracted by the federal government to do the systematic review for the upcoming guidelines. So for the first time in my life, I had to like really, really read deeply into papers and read a lot of papers. And first of all, it's really boring, so I recommend not doing that. But if you do do it, you'll find that papers are not nearly as good as you think they are, because this isn't for vitamin D, but for another project we did on fish oil. So in meta-analyses, they pool results of different studies. So a researcher will say, a randomized control trial is the gold standard of research. And then a meta-analysis is like even more of a gold standard, like a platinum standard, because it pulls together results of a bunch of different randomized trials. I don't actually have that view, because we used to do a lot of meta-analyses, and the thing that ends up happening is that because researchers have to publish stuff or else they get fired, meta-analysis is a good way to publish something without doing a study yourself. So it doesn't mean meta-analyses are bad, but what it does mean is that people who do meta-analyses are often not experts in that area. So we did have experts in vitamin D because we had a bunch of money that the government threw at us. But I used to read some meta-analyses on like fish oil, for example, and they would pull together results on fish oil, but they would pull together results from like Japan and the US and like Russia or something. But people in Japan eat so much more fish and seafood from the time that they're young, in addition to other differences between people from Japan and people from Western countries, that the studies really possibly shouldn't be pooled at all. And once you start pooling studies that are not similar and populations that aren't similar, then you're no longer getting a more accurate result by doing a meta-analysis. You're probably just muddying the waters. And then when a meta-analysis gets reported, then people take it as like a super truth. Like, oh, there's 15 studies included in this meta-analysis. It has to be true. It's not true. So it's very hard to detect those things, unfortunately. And you have to become familiar with the research to do that.
Yeah, so even these huge studies that come out that are studies of a whole bunch of studies, those are themselves flawed in many cases.
Yeah, and there's this sort of new thing called an umbrella review, which is a meta-analysis of meta-analyses. So, and it's crazy because on the one hand, there's only been one meta-analysis or umbrella review on a nutrition thing, I think. And it was a vitamin D, and coincidentally, it was by that guy, John Ioannidis, who did the study on 90% of medical findings being wrong. But he did this umbrella review of all the vitamin D outcomes because there's been so many different meta-analyses. And his conclusion was that vitamin D is basically overhyped, that there's not as much solid research as you would think for vitamin D helping conditions. So on the one hand, I think it's cool that he did that study, and there are a lot of outcomes that vitamin D may or may not be tied to that we just assume it is. But on the other hand, the meta-analysis loses so much granularity of the individual studies that once you do a meta-analysis of meta-analyses, you're losing any granularity. So like if a certain vitamin D study was done on postmenopausal women in Iowa, and then you pulled it together with the study of vitamin D in athletes, then you're already losing some granularity. But when you start pooling together different meta-analyses, then you're losing so much granularity that it's like, why are you doing it in the first place? Like, should you do a meta-analysis or a meta-analysis of all micronutrients so that you can say that a multivitamin is either good or bad? No, because a multivitamin is important because of the different micronutrients within it, not the fact that it's one pill. So I don't know. I'm just ranting at this point, but I think it's just very hard to understand research by a media headline. So you have to get into it.
You know what? One last quick question before I delve into asking you like some of the most proven supplements and stacks that you found on your, you know, in this research that you've been doing. And that is like the whole idea behind abstracts, right? Like a lot of times people will tweet an abstract or, you know, and I do that sometimes, right? Like I'll place a post to an abstract, not a full article. Are there any cautionary steps that people should take when they're just, you know, reading the basic abstract, the basic summary of a study without actually delving into the details of the study itself? I mean, is that dangerous to review an abstract? Are there like red flags that you should look for? What do you do when it comes to reviewing an abstract? Or if somebody's listening in, like what's the best way for them to get through an abstract that's looking at a supplement or a diet or an exercise program or something like that?
So when you look at an abstract, when I look at an abstract, then if it's an issue that's really important to me, either for work or for my personal health or family's health or something, I'll always look at the full text of the paper. If I can't look at the full text, then there are certain things in the abstract that are red flags. So,
right, because a lot of times you have to click and like pay a bunch of money for the
full text. Yeah, exactly. So if you see an abstract where they conclude that the intervention, let's say vitamin D, helped, but in the abstract, they just say that the vitamin D group had better outcomes than at baseline. So like the vitamin D group had improved blood pressure, or the vitamin D group had improved depression. That actually doesn't mean anything, because the placebo group also could have had improved depression or improved blood pressure. So really what it has to say explicitly is that vitamin D had a better improvement in blood pressure than the control group did. And that's the easiest trick in the book for researchers who are trying to get something published and of notoriety, because, you know, the reason you have a control group, a placebo in the first place, is so that you can compare that to the intervention. So once you take the control group out of the equation and you start reporting on the intervention group only, then you're not really following science. Because, you know, I could have a sugar pill and I could say, you know, sugar pill XYZ improved bowel movements, and it improved bowel movements by 30%. And then let's say that the placebo group improved bowel movements by 28%. So the difference was not statistically significant, but they don't have to technically report that in the abstract. So there's actually a lot of leeway in abstract writing, and it depends on the journal, and even some high quality journals sometimes miss things. So like when I've written abstracts, you know, I was always the low guy on the totem pole. So I would get vetoed, you know, I would say, oh, here's my abstract. And they'd be like, oh, really? You know, we actually need to change these things. And sometimes the change is to make the abstract better, but sometimes it's to make the abstract more catchy. So you have to watch out for those things. You never take the conclusion of the abstract as truth. You have to look at the results first.
Yeah, that's really good advice, because a lot of times when I'm, you know, let's say I'm reading like the Journal of Strength Conditioning Research, the abstract will definitely say one thing. And then when you dig into the article itself, the results are far less significant than the abstract may have seemed to imply. Or you find out, like, you know, methodologies used in the study that they don't even talk about in the actual abstract. You know, for example, they might say something like, power training results in zero improvement in endurance running economy. And, you know, in the abstract outlines, there was a power training group and a non-power training group, and, you know, no difference between the two. But then you go in and you actually read the methodology, and the power training group was maybe doing, you know, one set of 20 box jumps 3 days a week. And it was nothing like, you know, an actual true plyometric or power program that would be used for improving running economy. So a lot of times you really have to delve into the details. And I find that the abstracts can be a bit dangerous, especially if it's like that 1-2 combo of an abstract and then what we were alluding to earlier, like a media news article that's reporting what the media says about the abstract. That's like the most potent, dangerous 1-2 combo, in my opinion, for fooling somebody into thinking that something is or is not true, right? Like the media report on Time Magazine website, or the Huffington Post, and then they click through to the actual study, so it must be legitimate, and then all they get is the abstract. You don't read the full study and you wind up getting fooled.
Yeah, you should always think about the motivations of the person giving you information. So, you know, if it's a media headline, then it's a media headline. You know, it's something that they're using to sell advertising space or whatever. If it's somebody who's, you know, your friend, then they don't have any, you know, they don't have devious schemes trying to trick you. So at least you can get rid of that. But if it's somebody, you know, who's high carb or low carb or whatever carb, and they forward you a study like you mentioned earlier about training and carb levels, then you really have to look at the abstract closely, because technically an abstract, you know, in a perfect world would say the strengths and weaknesses of the study right there. It would say, you know, we looked at a high carb versus low carb diet for triathlon performance, and this is what we found. The strength of the study is that we had highly trained athletes, which mimics the population that is reading this article. But the weakness of this is that we looked at 10 different outcomes. We looked at time to completion of the triathlon. We looked at perceived exertion, blah, 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 blah. those outcomes are all correlated with each other. So if one is significant, there's a high chance that others will be too. So this is actually a flaw of the study. Or, you know, we had 15 people and one dropped out, so we no longer reached the number of people we needed in the power calculation. You know, those are all important things, but researchers do not have to put that stuff in the abstract. So you'll never find out what's wrong with the study. You'll only find out what's right with it.
Yeah, it's a rabbit hole that we could go down for a long time, but I want to delve into some of the fun stuff from your website. So let's start here, because I think that this might be surprising to folks. When it comes to supplements, there's a ton out there, obviously. So I'll cut straight to the chase. What are the top three most proven efficacious supplements in terms of general applicability for just about everyone that you think everyone could benefit from based on the research that you guys have done over there at Examine?
So I think there's probably only one that everybody really could benefit from, which is vitamin D. And that's because I try not to think of supplements, as a category, because basically when we research supplements, there's things that you supplement onto your diet because they're missing from your diet or lifestyle, like vitamin D. And then there's things that are like, I don't have a good term for this. At a talk at a conference, I said complements, because I was trying to think back to like algebra or trigonometry or whatever in middle school. When you complement an angle, then you're completing it or something. I don't know. But a supplement is something that you're supplementing onto what you already have. A complement to me is sort of like, you know, a treatment for something or prevention or something you tack on. So vitamin D is a supplement, and it's a common supplement because the sun is just such an important thing. And if you don't get sun, you know, we're designed around the sun. So you have to at least supplement part of the benefit you get from the sun. You know, it's only part of it, because you can't take vitamin D and all of a sudden you're happy, because being in the sun means you're probably more social, you're getting fresh air, there's nitric oxide synthesis, higher endorphin levels and whatnot. So, you know, you're like outsourcing part of the benefit in the form of a vitamin D pill. But there's nothing else that is really a supplement that everybody could benefit from, because other than not being outside, people differ for, you know, a lot of reasons. So like vitamin C or vitamin K2 or certain minerals can be helpful for large chunks of the population, but not for everybody. And for most things, except for, I guess, K2, there is some chance of harm. So that's why there's nothing that I recommend to everybody.
Okay, got it. Now, here's what comes to mind for me, though. When you say like vitamin D, well, two things come to mind. First of all, it seems like you get down a slippery slope, because when you say, oh, vitamin D would be the most recommended supplement that I would encourage everyone to take, then you run into the fact that in nature, you very rarely, you know, aside from exposure to sunlight, I suppose, find isolated forms of vitamin D, right? Usually it's delivered along with, for example, in liver, you know, vitamin A and vitamin E and vitamin K to prevent, you know, calcification from excessive vitamin D intake. Or, you know, when you look at eggs or the oils from fish, in many cases, it's accompanied by a host of other fat-soluble vitamins. So when you look at all the research behind vitamin D, Can you tell someone, hey, if you're going to take one supplement, just take vitamin D? Or do you get concerned about people getting, like, you know, calcification or something like that if you were to tell them to just take vitamin D?
So I actually don't recommend any supplements when people ask me personally. So on our website, we never use the word recommend on purpose, because like our stance is that you look at what you eat, you look at your lifestyle, and then you maybe try something as an adjunct and see if it helps. But when people ask me, or there's been a few times when I've worked in clinical situations. So there was a doctor I worked with in San Francisco who does a quantified self-tracking program for his patients. And around half his patients are former addicts, either of drugs or hard drugs or other things. And then half are kind of metabolic disease, former heart attack sort of patients. And we didn't recommend any supplements. So we always started with very simple self-tracking of just like, how did you feel that day? And, you know, like, how hard did you try to be healthy? And then we did that kind of stuff for a super, super long time, kind of like, you know, people who are really into weightlifting, probably at some point in the past 5 or 10 or 15 years have gone back to the basics with either the bar or the broomstick or whatever and worked on their squat form until they got it exactly right. And we would do that kind of thing with diet and lifestyle before we ever thought about taking a supplement, because like you said, vitamin D is not something that everybody needs to take. And I don't take vitamin D. And, you know, I tell my girlfriend she should take vitamin D just because she doesn't get outside much,
mm-hmm.
you know, and we live near the beach in San Francisco and it's always foggy. But for anybody who can get enough time outside in the sun, you know, I would never recommend vitamin D. So
now, but perhaps I should rephrase that question then when I say the most recommended supplements. Let me put it this way. What are the most researched supplements when you look at, for example, examine like the supplements that you think have the most references behind them? And then the goals may differ, right? It might be references for athleticism. It might be references for general health or, you know, cognitive performance. But what would be like the three top most researched supplements that you have, you know, reams of data on at Examine that appear to be like the darlings of the supplement industry when it comes to things that actually do have a lot of studies behind them?
So this is easier to answer. So creatine is probably one of them. And the reason is simple. It's just because creatine has a fairly high chance of working, you know, working in quotes, providing some increase in some outcome. And that's pretty simple because creatine is a very basic molecule that isn't hard to understand why it would have its effects. And there's been a lot of research on both creatine benefits and on various forms of creatine that basically never work as well as creatine monohydrate.
Mm-hmm.
So creatine, you know, let's say every supplement has between a 0 and 100% chance of helping a given person. Creatine has a higher chance than most supplements. So that's one of the most researched supplements.
Yeah. And by the way, if I could throw it in there, a lot of people think creatine, I used to be under this impression, it's just for like football players and bodybuilders and strength and power athletes. But it actually has a lot of really cool neuroprotective and cardioprotective properties. Like I recommend to just about everybody, you know, and especially vegans and vegetarians to take around 5 grams of creatine a day.
Yeah. So we actually recently, or like a year ago or so, covered a creatine study for depression. And it was the first study showing that creatine helped major depression. And, you know, I won't get into the methodology pros and cons, but those are important. But it was cool because mechanistically it makes sense. So there's a couple ways that creatine could help the brain. And one is that in neural pathways in the brain, like all organs, tries to be efficient in its setup. You know, we store energy is fat because it's efficient. You know, it's a lot of calories per gram. That's why we're not like huge bags of glycogen, because then we'd be like, you know, extremely voluminous. But the brain also tries to be efficient. So it's mostly short connections and then connections between those connections. But there's some longer connections, wider connections. So if the brain is a bunch of streets, then these connections would be like, you know, major freeways or highways. And those are called rich club connections. So creatine could increase the prevalence of those rich club connections. So it makes sense that creatine could help major depression. So this isn't like, you know, I'm feeling sad or I'm taking an SSRI sometimes, but this is major depression where you're thinking either I get, you know, electroconvulsive therapy or I try some crazy thing like, you know, a ketamine infusion or something. Creatine could help that kind of thing. And that's where, you know, kind of my faith in supplements is restored, because there's a lot of crap out there. But if something as simple as creatine could help, or something as simple as a ketogenic diet for, you know, epilepsy or whatever, then it's all worth it, because that Right. research does do something.
Yeah, and that's what I like about the site too, is I can go and look at whether or not that fancy expensive brand of creatine that is, you know, advertised at bodybuilding.com, for example, or T Nation has any benefits over and above, say, like, you know, a creatine monohydrate or something along those lines. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it's useful in that way. And the other thing, of course, is you have a couple of other supplements I've noticed on your most researched supplements line. It appears to be fish oil and marijuana as the next two most researched supplements.
Yeah, so fish oil is interesting because if anybody's ever looked into the history of fish oil as a trend is almost brand new. So fish oil used to be a waste product, and then, you know, it was used as like maybe like fuel for lamps or something. And then fast forward a while, and directly as a product of, you know, demonizing fat, and then transitioning to, oh, maybe a little bit of polyunsaturated fats, mostly omega-3 is good. And then some early studies about fish oil possibly being useful for some cholesterol outcomes, fish oil exploded. You know, within the span of 5 years, probably in the late 90s or so, fish oil went from 0 to 100 miles an hour. And then that's right around when Pfizer and some other companies started researching fish oil as a pharmaceutical. So probably most listeners know that that's a scam. So Lovaza as a fish oil pill is a scam. You know, there's never going to be a trial of Lovaza versus the fish oil from Costco because it'll be exactly the same. The difference is that the fish oil from Costco will cost, you know, $200 for a year's supply, and Lovaza is like $1,600 or something. So it's draining money from our healthcare system to make fish oil into a pharmaceutical. There is a pharmaceutical that's mostly EPA that's coming out that could be better for certain cardiovascular intermediaries. But, you know, the reason people get heart attacks is not because they're missing fish oil in their diet. So fish oil is highly researched because there's money to be made from it. And because, you know, it's something that that's easily gotten from fish. But it's not one of the most useful supplements.
Interesting. So even though there's reams and reams of research behind it, that doesn't necessarily mean that the research has shown it to be extremely efficacious.
Yeah. As far as like, if you were to make a quotient of amount of research over usefulness, then I think fish oil would be close to number one on there.
Okay, interesting. And I did note that one of the things that seemed to be beneficial for fish oil in terms of your guys' kind of like summary of it is that it appears to be most beneficial for decreasing triglycerides, which I know are an independent risk factor for heart disease. And, you know, I for example, work with Wellness FX. I do, you know, every Thursday I'm poring over people's blood results with them for, you know, 4 to 6 hours. That's my block of time to do my Wellness FX consults. And a lot of people have extremely high triglycerides and very low HDL, which is, you know, that triglyceride HDL ratio is a risk factor for heart disease. So in that case, I would, you know, I often make the recommendation for something like fish oil to decrease high triglyceride levels.
Yeah, so this is where it starts getting a little bit more subtle. So for things like fish oil and even for statins, so they're not in the same category, but, you know, some doctors basically think that statins should be in the water supply. And then some more progressive doctors think that statins are, you know, extremely overused and shouldn't be used by anybody and have more side effects than benefits. Then the truth is probably somewhere in the middle, and the same is true for fish oil. So if you have a history of heart disease, if your triglycerides are very high, if you're not eating a great diet and you're not likely to eat a great diet for the foreseeable future, and some other factors, then fish oil is not a bad idea as long as you're not taking a ton of it. But fish oil is not something that everybody would take, you know, so it's very similar to statins, because if you're a 70-year-old man who's had a heart attack, then the decision to take a statin is very different than a 40-year-old man who hasn't had a heart attack, you know, even if your cholesterol numbers aren't very good. So fish oil is neither bad nor good. It's a complex story somewhere in the middle. And unfortunately, that's true with almost every supplement. There's very few that's not the case with, and it's usually sort of either things extracted from food or foods themselves. So
right. Right. And admittedly, I take a fish oil every day. You know, I've seen some of the other research that shows that it could decrease the risk of diabetes, which I by the way, have a 5 times higher than normal risk for, based on my, my genetic testing. And it also significantly decreases risk of a lot of different forms of cancer and plaque buildup. And so like I take it, I suspect that a lot of the research potentially, is not all using like good non-oxidized, non-rancid forms of fish oil. And you know, so I use fish oil. I really do. I use fish oil. a creatine and a multivitamin. Like those are three things that I take just about every day. And
yeah, I think that's probably a pretty safe group of supplements to take. And like you said, fish oil quality is important. We don't do specific brand names, but if you do take fish oil, then if you're questioning the oxidation or heavy metals or whatever, then there is a database, IFOS, International Fish Oil Standards, that does voluntary testing of most of the major brands. So,
Okay, gotcha.
It's always good to, I'm sure you're taking good fish oil because you know a lot about supplements, but for some listeners, it's probably good to look at that kind of website.
Yeah, the fish oil I take, it is, again, admittedly expensive, but yeah, you want to make, what I tell people is taking bad fish oil is much worse than not taking fish oil at all.
The one thing I was going to say about fish oil is that everybody has a complex history, so it's always good to either hire somebody who's really smart and knowledgeable or have a friend who is, or try to find a primary care doctor that is, because, you know, like you said, you've had genetic testing done. You've looked into research about fish oil and different outcomes. Not everybody does that. So like my family's full of thin diabetics. You know, my mom weighs 105 pounds and she's a type 2 diabetic. My grandma is the same. My uncle, I have a high chance for diabetes. So I look into supplements that somebody else wouldn't look into. My family is also vegetarian. So, you know, I grew up not eating a lot of meat except for the pepperoni on my pizza at school and that kind of thing. So, you know, as I got more into ancestral health and thinking outside of just studies, then I started thinking like, am I different than the people that are being looked at in this research? Because I'm from a region of the world, Northwest India, that has probably been vegetarian for longer than almost any other place on earth, you know, several hundred years. So is my iron metabolism different? My fatty acid metabolism, is that different? We covered a study a year ago about how people from Northern Africa and Southern Asia have different fatty acid metabolism because they ate higher plant diets. So in order to convert smaller chain fats to longer chain fats, you know, you had to have a different mechanism for that in your body. So there was a selective advantage to produce a different longer chain fats from plants. So now that could be a disadvantage. It could be a reason why some regions in India have higher incidence of heart disease because we're making more harmful long chain fats. So, you know, I think about these kind of things and about how some research could, you know, inform me and some research couldn't. But I know that not everybody has a job like I do where I have to read papers. So, you know, outsource it to somebody, find reputable people, websites, people who are interested in yourself and become friends with them because it's the best thing you can do for your health.
Gotcha. Now, when it comes to supplements, are there any supplements out there that you think people are very infatuated with or the media researchers are quite infatuated with that have very low credibility? Like, is there one supplement that you think a lot of people are taking that has very, very little research behind it, whether it's something that the athletic population is using pre-workout or some kind of recovery supplement or something that you just know is pretty much across the board, something that has very little research or is even potentially damaging?
So for the general public, libido boosters or testosterone boosters are, you know, there's not a lot of research for most of them or almost all of them. But I would think that your audience is, you know, pretty in tune with that, like not taking a bunch of random supplements because they think it might boost their testosterone.
Actually, you know what? I think a lot of my audience, they're popping a lot of pills. I've seen the emails come in. Like some folks are taking like 30 different pills in the morning.
So, testosterone, and then the two major categories are testosterone boosters and fat loss supplements. So, you know, there are things that could help, but there's just so much bad research compared to the good research. But less obvious than that, I'd say, is probiotic research. So there's a ton of probiotic research, and probiotics have been shown to be helpful for certain things. But, you know, I can't count the number of ways that it's been misleading. So if you take a step back from probiotics, even the way that people throw around the term, like, oh, you know, try probiotics, what does that even mean? Because, you know, you don't say, oh, why don't you try food for your diabetes? Because probiotics are different species of bacteria. They're not at all similar to each other. So, you know, you don't recommend that, oh, hey, go ahead and eat food for that because plants are different than animals and fruits are different than vegetables and different fruits are different than other fruits. You know, If you have some gut issues, then some vegetables and some fruits could maybe increase, you know, histamine problems, and some could help with them. So similarly, some bacteria can help with their issues and some can harm you. So that's why for probiotics, I think you really have to look into the research, and research is extremely overhyped. Plus, people rarely think about dosages much. They only think of dosages in terms of the more the better, like, oh, 10 billion units or 20 billion is better than 10. But you already have a complex ecosystem of bacteria and other organisms in your gut. So you don't necessarily want to throw in a ton of stuff in there right away. So if you have a sensitive gut, if you have IBS, especially if you have Crohn's or ulcerative colitis, it's probably smarter to do something like, you know, either take the capsule apart and start with a microdose and then increase it over time, or start with like a little bit of sauerkraut juice or something, because you don't necessarily want to interrupt what's going on in your gut. Like if you get a colonoscopy, sometimes a colonoscopy will help with your symptoms because you're washing out gut bacteria. But it's a double-edged sword, because once you start eating crappy again, then there's a lot of kind of, there's like a vacuum, and nature abhors a vacuum. So once there's a vacuum in your gut, then you can get a huge buildup of bad bacteria very quickly. So similarly, you don't want to necessarily interrupt what's already going on in your gut. So I think it's good to think about the probiotics that you're taking and not just start with a ton of them all at once.
That's really good advice, because a lot of people really will think that probiotics not only more are better, but that using the widest variety and array of probiotics is important. And again, I think it comes out of testing, right? We were talking about genetics and diabetes and fish oil. You know, you can also get a gut biome test, or you can get, you know, the 3-day poop panel. It's my favorite, where, you know, where you poop in a little hot dog tray and send it off with a prepaid FedEx label. And you can find out, you know, which specific bacteria you're deficient in, which you're high in, which you're low in, and supplement accordingly, rather than just painting with a broad brush. You know, I also wanted to point out the fact that, for example, at Examine's website, you guys have, you know, you mentioned testosterone boosters. You have, for example, I see one page on here where you do list four things that actually do have decent research behind them for testosterone. You've got DHEA on here, vitamin D, zinc, and fenugreek as four things that actually can help with testosterone. And so, you know, that's actually what I like about the site and some of your stat guides, is rather than me like taking some testosterone supplement that's got like, you know, 18 different ingredients in it that purportedly assist with testosterone levels, I could just go and pop the few things that actually have research behind them. You know, the things that you guys would call like a stack that actually has good research. That leads me to another question that I wanted to ask you. And that is regarding stacks. Now, you have this enormous stack guide that you guys have produced, and I own it. I'll put a link to it and all this stuff again in the show notes if you go to bengreenfieldfitness.com/examinepodcast. And you list a whole bunch of stacks, everything from cognitive performance to enhancing testosterone to, you know, fighting inflammation, et cetera. But for you personally, what would you say, you know, for the folks listening in, when it comes to stacking supplements, putting a bunch of supplements together at once, what would you say is the most beneficial stack that you've come across, or one that you use daily, or the stack that you like the best when it comes to general applicability to folks?
So the thing that's probably most applicable to the highest percentage of people is caffeine related stacks. So do you drink coffee?
I do. I have since I was 13 years old. My dad was a gourmet coffee roaster growing up. So I have dumped copious amounts of coffee into my body from a young age.
So I guess I'm the inverse of you, because I had one cup when I was 11 or so, and I've never had coffee since then. So and I don't know if it's because I'm a super taster, or just I'm also a slow caffeine metabolizer. But the thing that I see most often is supplement wise is caffeine, because people drink coffee a lot. They often don't think twice about it, whether it's benefits or detriments. So caffeine-related things are very important. You know, when people ask me for advice on stuff, I always say, look at the things that are most prevalent in your life. So people drink coffee a lot. People are in bed a lot. People sit at their desk a lot. So because of those things, caffeine-related stuff is going to be important. The type of bed you sleep on and your light exposure before bed is going to be important. And your posture or lack thereof while working, you know, at a cubicle or at your desk is important. And if you can take care of those things, that's like, you know, 80 to 90% of it. So with caffeine, people will drink caffeine and be jittery and not think twice about it. They're just like, oh, you know, I didn't get a lot of sleep, so I drank an extra cup of coffee, and now I can't function at work, and I'm just on Facebook all day because my mind is racing. So caffeine and L-theanine is the most basic stack that applies to the most people. L-theanine is found in green tea, but it's also isolated, so you can take it as a supplement. But for a decent chunk of people, L-theanine counteracts that jitteriness. So you still get some focus from caffeine, but you know, you can think logically, and you can function basically. So I think that's probably the most useful stack for most people.
So it's caffeine, theanine, and what?
It's just caffeine and L-theanine. There are other things.
Okay, so just caffeine, theanine.
Yeah. But that's the most basic, I'd say. And then I guess for if you're not looking to like what's happening that day, if you're looking for health, I guess, this isn't technically a stack, but nitrate containing vegetables, I think it's good to I guess stack them together. So if you have a history of heart disease or family history or high triglycerides or whatever, the most basic thing you can do is to regularly eat vegetables that contain nitrates. And the reason is that nitrates are good for heart health because they increase dilation in blood vessels. And it's also good for performance as well. You know, nitrates or beet juice or whatever before a workout is usually fairly effective. But nitrates have a fairly short half-life. So in order to get benefits from nitrates throughout the day, it's good to eat vegetables like maybe twice or even three times throughout the day, especially if you have some heart health issues. Then you're getting the benefits stretched out for longer. So, you know, find vegetables that are higher in nitrates, pick out two or three that, you know, taste good to you, and buy them at the grocery store a lot. So that's not really a stack, but if you find two or three that you like, make it a staple.
That's actually really good advice. I don't think anybody's brought up before on this show to spread your vegetable intake throughout the day specifically so you get the advantages of nitrate. I like that.
Yeah, there's some spread out supplements or spread out foods that people don't think of. So have you ever megadosed vitamin C?
I have. Yeah, I actually did that last week when I came back from you can hear I'm slightly congested still. I got hypothermic while spearfishing in Costa Rica and came back with a bit of a cold. And so I took quite a bit of vitamin D, echinacea, elderberry, and oregano. That was my stack.
Okay, that's a pretty solid cold stack, I'd say. So I guess you must be up on the research, but vitamin C.
Well, you know, I have the examine.com supplement stack guide here on my desktop.
Not to humble brag, but you must be looking at a good website. So, you know, vitamin C is another thing where, and, you know, I'm just going to keep repeating this over and over again until it sinks in with everybody. No supplement is inherently good or bad. So always look at the pros and the cons. And also, I try to look into things that I don't know a lot about. So, like at the library I used to go to, there was this big painting of some ancient physician, and it was a quote, "Teach thy tongue to say I do not know, and thou shalt prosper." So I try to really take it to heart now and look into things that I don't know about, because everybody has their pet issues, but I want to know about things that I don't know. So like with vitamin C, when I first got into nutrition when I was 18 or 19, then I was like, oh, vitamin C is so good, Linus Pauling and all this stuff. And then I looked into the research and I was like, oh, vitamin C is so overrated. And then now it's, you know, sort of in between, because the more I looked into research and the more I looked into clinical experiences, the more I found that people were often taking like, you know, 5 grams of vitamin C at once. And they're like, oh, it's just diarrhea and I don't feel better and I hate vitamin C. But the bioavailability of vitamin C is such that basically, after 500 milligrams, every time you double the dose, the bioavailability goes down by more than half. So that means that 1 gram won't produce diarrhea in most people. 2 grams, possibly not as well. You know, 4 grams, yes. So when physicians used to, there's things like vitamin C, iodine, some other nutrients were used, you know, back in the day, like our great grandparents and such. Well, not great grandparents, because they didn't really even know vitamins existed, but our grandparents, they would say, oh, if you're sick, then, you know, iodine or vitamin C could be the thing that helps. And that's because a lot of people don't eat a lot of seafood or sea vegetables, and iodine is critical for a lot of things. Vitamin C, you need more vitamin C in times of stress. So if you take vitamin C at in a rational protocol, you know, like 1,000 milligrams, and if you can tolerate that, then 2,000. And then if you can tolerate that, 2,000 every 2 or 3 hours. Then I think taking it in times of stress or before a high stress event, like if you're doing, you know, an ultra marathon, or I don't know about that, because there's the whole like adaptation with antioxidants, but
right, blunting the hormetic response.
Yeah. But if you're going to be stressed out, let's say what's not physically stressful, a chess tournament, then megadosing on vitamin C could be a good thing, you know, and it really depends on spreading it out. And then there's other times people don't think about dosages. Like, there isn't any research right now on optimal times to take vitamin D. Like, there used to be this anecdote, oh, if I take vitamin D at night, then I can't fall asleep. And it must be because people usually get sun exposure in the daylight hours. Well, that doesn't really make sense, because when you take vitamin D, it's not like it's used right away. You know, it's a different pathway than when it gets synthesized through the skin. So researchers don't really know if there's bad or good times to take vitamin D. Researchers don't really know, like, if you can wash vitamin D off your skin with soap. So there's things that people don't know about protocols that could be really important. So just because you take a supplement and it doesn't have an effect doesn't necessarily mean it won't have an effect. You know, look at different dosing schedules at different doses. Like with probiotics, think about what you're taking it with. Like vitamin D, everybody knows that it's fat soluble, but vitamin D isn't actually absorbed that well if you take it with a lot of fat. It's absorbed much better if you take it with a small amount of fat. So if you take it with no fat, it's not absorbed well. If you take it with like half a stick of butter, it's not absorbed well. But if you take it with a little bit of fat, it is absorbed well. So there's just a lot of intricacies that you have to think about before saying a supplement works or doesn't work.
Yeah, and that's why I appreciate what you guys do on the website, because I can't tell you how many times during the week I'll simply visit the stat guide or the supplement goals reference guide on my desktop and pull up the PDF, go through it. And, you know, when somebody asks me a question, I can actually delve into research that is produced by someone who's not selling supplements, which to me is quite valuable. And for those of you listening in, basically, you know, there's three things that I get from Examine that in full disclosure, I have purchased each of these. Their stack guide, which is a whole, I think there's 17 different guides in that stack guide, but it's like step-by-step directions for, you know, stacks like Kamal just went into, right? Caffeine and L-theanine, how much to take, how often you'd take that, in which dose, with or without food, etc. Then they have their supplement goals reference guide, which is, it's big, but it's not meant to be read cover to cover, right? Like when you have a question about a supplement, or when one of your friends says, hey, I'm taking the newest form of beta alanine in some type of extreme lipophilic deliverability system, you can go into the supplement goals reference guide and see, you know, over 5,000 human studies and look at 400, or actually more than 400 different health goals that something like that may or may not be applicable for, you know, whether it be testosterone or power or strength or pooping better or, you know, whatever. And then they've also got their Examine Research Digest, which, you know, that's how I led into this podcast. You know, one of the things I'm big into are digests or newsletters or ways that I can cut through information quickly, ways that I can more or less, you know, biohack my digestion of copious amounts of research. And the Examine Research Digest, you know, it's basic, it's very straightforward. It's 6 new studies you get into your inbox. They're analyzed every month. They're in audio, so you can listen to them, or they're in PDF, so you can read them. And they're also printable. So that's a good way to stay on top of the latest research. And it is something that the lay population can consume. You don't have to be a propeller hat wearing nerd or a lab coat donning researcher to get benefit out of that one. So I'll put links to each of those in the show notes over at bengreenfieldfitness.com/ Examine podcast, where I'll also put links to a lot of the things that Kamal and I talked about, like the IFOS website for testing fish oil, the ugly website I mentioned that has good research on sleep, caffeine, theanine blends, the gut panel for testing bacterial balance. I'll put as much as I can on there for you guys to access. And then, of course, leave your comments, leave your questions. And if you really dig this episode, leave a review over on iTunes. Kamal, thanks for coming on and sharing all this stuff with us. I love what you're doing, and I'm just super duper stoked that I could get you on the call today and dig into your mind a bit.
It's my pleasure. It's always good to talk shop with somebody who knows stuff.
Awesome. Well, folks, if you're listening in, I'm Ben Greenfield along with Kamal Patel, signing out from BenGreenfieldFitness.com. And again, BenGreenfieldFitness.com/examine podcast is where the show notes reside. Have a healthy week.
You've been listening to the Ben Greenfield Fitness Podcast. Go to BenGreenfieldFitness.com for even more cutting-edge fitness and performance advice.